Comic Timing is a member of the Comics Podcast Network, bitch.
Welcome to episode 39, part 1 of Comic Timing, a comics podcast devoted to the average comic book fan from the average comic book fan. Join in as a rotating panel of guests and myself, Ian Levinson, discuss whatever comes to mind, time after time, here on Comic Timing. It has been a very long time since Comic Timing has delved into the world of 52. The time has come today. Do the rest of it. David D. and John Mayo join myself for an in-depth discussion of the second half of 52 and the beginning of Countdown. What did we think of the second half? Well, you sure as hell are about to find out. Here now, Comic Timing. Hey there, folks. My name's Ian Levinstein, and welcome to episode 39 of Comic Timing. I would have liked it to be episode 52. However, it's just not the way it turned out. Sorry, folks. This is the second half of 52, literally, because the last time we did anything on 52 was a long, long time ago. Issue 22, to be exact. So technically, we're doing a little bit more than half here, but we're running through issues 23 to 52, including World War III, and then we're going to touch a little bit on Countdown 51 and 50 as the time goes on. But let me introduce the panel first. They are returning from the last episode that we did on 52. I'll introduce the regular first, the guy who was on last episode about religion. And this time, it's a little bit less holy. It's John Mayo.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well, man. How you going?
I'm doing all right. Doing all right. Looking forward to the discussion.
As am I. And joining us via the landline, he's like E.T. because his name is Double D. It is David D.
Yes, I'm sorry the grandpa still has the landline. I'll catch up to the 21st century one of these days with the Skype that all the kids talk about.
Oh, yeah. Skype, you know what? You're better off without it. That's fine. As long as we can hear you on the landline, then life is easy, man. You don't have to worry about all the strange oddities that can occur with the internet sometimes.
I can only imagine.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, welcome back, man. It's been a while.
Yes, I hope you guys have had a great 30 weeks since the last time we spoke.
I've had two children, and
good.
Surprisingly enough, I live in Omaha now. Other than that, I'm fine. So,
I've saved the world 4 times. Unfortunately, I also got it destroyed 8. So, you know, a little behind.
It's all right. There's 52 worlds to go through. Oops, I'm spoilering. Well, we're going to be spoilering all throughout this episode, so let me throw that out there for you. We're not going to pull a Comic Geek Speak, you know, Spider-Man 3 episode where all of a sudden we throw out spoilers and don't tell you ahead of time. Oh, anyway.
Oh, come on. That was punk rock. Gotta get people's ears to perk up every once in a while.
I haven't listened to the episode. You're spoiling it for me. I haven't even seen the movie yet, to be honest.
I have to tell you, though, when I did actually hear that, and this isn't giving anything away about the episode, but I was laughing hysterically. They gave away some 52 spoilers accidentally. One of the members in the room hadn't read issue 52 yet, and to say the least, they were a bit upset.
Although, if it helps, they didn't give away anything that Dan DiDio hadn't given away months before his column.
Which we will get into as well here, but anyway.
One of the worser kept secrets.
Yes.
You know.
Well, as far as spoilers go, guys, I am completely caught up on the DC Universe as of this moment, aside from, I think, Ex Machina, which is Vertigo and not part of the DCU, and Fables, which is Vertigo and, again, not part. Actually, the other one's Wildstorm, sorry.
Oh, everything.
I was about to say,
you're that guy that actually knows what's been happening in Aquaman for the last year.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Am I sorry.
Hey, the first couple of issues were not that bad, all right? But then I dropped it.
You missed the change of the artists on the last one.
Okay.
And as worried as I was about Tad Williams, who did the next, which is one of the few miniseries I've dropped halfway through. The art is what's really getting me on Aquaman right now.
Yeah, see, I dropped the next after issue 1 when I realized it wasn't next wave, so.
Oh.
Yeah. I wrote a comment to Sean and Jim when they talked about it on their show. They made a logo that looked just like next wave. The cover art looked just like Stuart Immonen. And they made it seem like it was going to be a wacky, kooky book. And then you open it up, and it's the complete opposite. So they were definitely riding off the coattails of Warren Ellis there. But that's in my mind, at least. I don't know whether people are going to
agree. No, I can actually, given the content and stuff, I can kind of sort of see it. I didn't have that confusion.
Yeah.
But then I read it, and yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Ian.
Yeah.
Ian, you're not going to name drop the whole episode, are you, with all this, I was talking to Sean and Jim and made the comments on there.
Well, it was funny. I was actually talking to David D. the other day, and he told me... All right. Let's get this baby going here. Let's actually read from the forum here. We have only one comment, but it's okay. We'll be talking most of the time anyway. We return, as I said, for issues 23 to 52, to be exact, along with countdown number 51 and 50. Did 52 deliver as you hoped it would? Were you on the mark with any of your initial guesses on where the series would turn? Are there any heroes you felt deserved more or less time in the series than they actually received? What was your favorite moment? Out of the remaining heroes, who do you think will get their own series, and who would you like to see as the creative team? Do you feel that Countdown comes too soon after 52? Did issue number 51 of Countdown leave you aching for more? And finally, what is your opinion on the current state of the DC Universe now that its most ambitious achievement has wrapped up? So, a bunch of stuff to cover here, but let's start nice and general first, and we'll start off with the guy on the phone, David. The second half of 52, as good as the first?
Yeah, better, I'd say, better. I also want to put out there, just as a game for the, you know, for the conversation that we're going to have, quick anecdote. My girlfriend was away this weekend with her family. When she came back, she brought some of her mother's cookies. I just want to put it out there that the first time that I hear the words space team, I'm going to get to eat one of those cookies.
Ooh.
Because I'm sure they'll come up.
Okay.
So if we hear any space team, space hospital talk, I get a cookie.
And every time we see Lobo,
I hope you have a lot of cookies.
Yeah, exactly. And every time you see Lobo or say Lobo, you take a drink.
Take a drink. Okay. I just wanted to establish that as ground rule.
But I can avoid those words pretty easily.
but then I'll get no cookie. So, you know, I just want there to be something in it for me when we have to talk about the space.
That's fair. That's fair. Because that is a subject I want to talk about.
Definitely.
No, I'm just making a joke. No, second half, yeah, I'd say, it's funny, generally, better than the first, although I suppose I'll subvert expectations by starting off with a negative, you know, since I'm well known as somebody that perhaps likes 52 more than one should.
Yeah.
I will say that in the second half, while there were some big payoffs and there was some great stuff and some wonderful reveals, I also, at the point towards the end where it became clear that it actually wasn't going to be all one big story, that, you know, that actually some of these storylines of these various threads were going to pay off and then actually finish, and then we'd go over here and pay off another one and it would finish, and some of these threads would only be tangentially related, that was actually a little bit of a letdown, you know, and because I think last time we spoke, at the point that we were at week 22, I still imagine that not only, you know, that the things as different from each other as, you know, say, Ralph's story and Black Adam were going to somehow intersect.
Yeah.
And we did find out when we got to the end of it, it was still a great ending that I enjoyed, but you kind of went, oh, okay, so on some level, it still feels like a novel, but instead of it being a novel in which the climax is shared across the storyline, it's more like one of those novels that's actually kind of a combination of a bunch of short stories.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, if it were a film, it would be more like your Robert Altman Shortcuts or your, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson Magnolia, you know, where people share a theme and, you know, they share space and time, but some of them never even meet each other.
It's kind of like Crash.
Okay, but,
like Crash in that way.
I'll take your word for it. But, you know, that sort of, that series of vignettes, that there's a thing that, you know, that they all share, even if there's never a point in which they're all on deck for the same big scene at the end.
Now, flipping that around, suppose that everything did tie in together at the end, and this was all just, you know, different angles coming to a major convergence or whatever. Don't you think that might have felt a little contrived, potentially?
Absolutely, no, and I think that's a great point. And you know, and that's true. That, I mean, on the, because it, I think there was a part of me that was loving it so much that I thought that they were going to somehow do that, and it wasn't going to seem hokey. It wasn't going to seem like your typical climax to a story in which suddenly you've got your, you know, Superman with the flag flying forward and everybody's flying behind them, and there's a kind of way in which arbitrarily everybody just runs at the danger at the same time. So I absolutely take your point that I think that there probably wasn't a way to connect all of these storylines together in a way that wouldn't be completely ham-handed. So had I got what I thought I wanted, it probably would have ended up being really conventional. Better that they didn't.
The funny thing is, I think with World War III, they had that opportunity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they didn't go there. They didn't go there. I mean, World War III, again, is something that we'll talk about later on, but World War III, what I thought was going to be something that was, you know, essential to the plot, seemed to have did everything that the original solicitations for 52 told us was going to happen. And
well, I was actually thinking just issue 50 itself. I mean,
okay.
I like to differentiate World War III in 52 and World War III the series.
I
think you almost have to.
Okay.
In fact, the World War III, the event, I like to differentiate it in sort of a kind of a plastic odor-free bag, sort of a bag that's separate, a sanitary sort of hazmat.
I'd like it to be in that 53rd universe that no one ever talks about. You know?
Oh, right. Yeah. The one with the sludge monsters, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean well, just going with the idea, though, that, you know, the original solicitations told us, you know, what happened during the missing year. Find out what happened to your favorite heroes during the missing year, yada, yada, yada. And we got the story of, you know, certain groups of DC players, third stringers, as it were, who, you know, came together in their own stories and eventually got to a conclusion. Better than, in my opinion, Infinite Crisis did, because Infinite Crisis left dangling plot points I did not want to see dangle. 52 didn't do that. But we did not get the 52 that was originally solicited. However, I'm happy we got the 52 that we got, if that makes any sense.
It does, and I agree. And I think the fact that there may have been no way to grab, you know, Ralph's storyline and pull it over to Black Adam's, for example, is probably a leftover of that course correction. You know,
yeah.
I mean, DiDio and others have been really public in the fact that very early on, I believe they said in week two or something, you know, at the point where basically their team of writers were taking the premise and really breaking it down into weeks and stories and beginning to script, I think they realized that, you know, the thing they'd set out to do was, from a narrative point of view, probably going to be really unsatisfying. You know, they picked their cast members based on the notion that they would be guides.
Yeah.
You know, that they kind of first, it sounds like they first subdivided the DC universe into kind of areas, you know, magic and space and street-level detective stuff and high-flying gods and, you know, all the things that these characters that they picked would naturally be able to kind of lead you into, and then they would be the people that would kind of go over here and they'd see what Aquaman's doing, and then they'd go over there and they'd look at Catwoman's pregnant belly and they'd go over here, and that would be sort of the series.
Yeah.
And I think that, like all writers do, when you start to spend a lot of time with a character, you know, I mean, I remember one of the podcasts that the writers did, they talked about how amazing it was to kind of have meetings where they'd essentially sit around a table and kind of geek out, it sounds like, you know, where they'd suddenly realize, we've just talked about Booster Gold for 3 hours. You know, when you start to invest so much energy creatively in your guides, suddenly your guides become the characters. You know, suddenly they become the thing that's more interesting to you than the sort of what to me would have been like a continuity newspaper. Like, instead of them just being your sort of reporters, your detectives that are going to kind of come over here and see, you know, how the Birds of Prey are doing this week, instead you kind of look at these people and go, you know what, actually the story of Ralph trying to get his wife back is so much more interesting than Ralph just kind of shining a lantern all over the various magic characters and watching them pass a year. So probably at the point where they, you know, they launched these stories and they picked these characters, and, you know, the big ship was, whatever metaphor you want to, I'm mixing all of them, you know, the ship was kind of already heading out the gate.
Yeah.
I will bang several more, and this ship will hit several more metaphors before it turns. You know, at the point where they decided to go, you know what, actually, let's just make the 1 year later hole patching somebody else's problem, and let's just really get into telling a story with these wonderful characters that we've picked. So probably, to get back to what we were originally talking about, the fact that the storylines didn't come together is probably another thing that's a leftover of that course correction.
Yeah.
But like you said, Ian, I'm really glad they did. You know, to me, I mean, not to bring it right back in, but to me, one of the things that was so unsuccessful about those World War III tie-in issues is that they felt workmanlike. They felt like, well, I'm Martian Manhunter, but hey, look, it's Aquaman. Uh-huh. How you been? You know, like, there's just moments where you kind of go, this is work.
Yeah, like Donna Troy going out of nowhere, all of a sudden deciding, without any true explanation on my end, to put on the Wonder Woman outfit.
Sure, why not?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, she just, like, decides out of nowhere, hey, you know what? It's World War III. I should go in there as Wonder Woman, because Wonder Woman should be part of every war possible. You know?
Well, it was like they had a checklist somebody had handed them of these things are the 1 year later mysteries that, you know, go toss something out there to kind of sort of explain it.
Yeah.
And the really sad thing about the World War III miniseries is not only was it so disjointed, so almost contrived in some places, it felt like the writers and the creators hadn't read the 1 year later stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because some of the explanations they gave as you know, ham-handed, over-the-top, and expository dialogue-filled as they were, don't fit with the stories that were already published at that point,
yeah.
And long since published.
And of all things, the only one that felt real to me was Manhunter. And not Martian Manhunter, but Manhunter. Because that literally was about 4 pages out of the World War III miniseries, and that felt the most true to a character. I'm not quite sure how they managed to do that, but her story was the one I look forward to the most. And I'm glad
I tell you, to me, having not yet read that Manhunter series, I hear it's very good. I probably end up getting the trade. But
yeah.
Having not yet read it, I found that scene was complete nonsense to me.
Sure.
It was like, you know, it would be, it's like opening a novel in the middle. I didn't know
exactly.
Who anybody was.
Yeah.
I didn't know why it was important.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't even tell what was revealed. And while it's not really fair for me to make this comparison, because, of course, had the same creative team with the same lead time and Keith Giffen's help and all that stuff, set out to do the entire to do that kind of continuity newspaper guidebook thing. Sure, I'm sure it would have been better than those World War III issues ended up being. You know, those things really did feel like they were kind of produced to problem solve in a crunch. But at the same time, how unsatisfying they were, to me, does kind of make me see a little bit of what the, you know, of why just telling a piece of time instead of telling a story.
Yeah.
Doesn't work. Like, you know, it just to me, it's like those are the kind of the symptoms of probably what happened when those writers started to kind of break this down into week by week and go, you know, sure, we can throw in a scene where we peek in on this character, where we like look in on what Harvey Dent is doing, but it doesn't really mean anything compared to this other story over here. You know, it's like the only thing these guys have in common are that they're living in the DC universe on the same week. There's no theme to it.
Yeah.
You know, and we're having to put over a bunch of ideas made by a bunch of other people. You know, I mean, for all we know, you know, these writers, just like, you know, John Ostrander and Blank,
yeah,
you know,
Keith,
the other,
Champagne.
Keith Champagne, maybe they just don't have any feeling in their heart for, you know, maybe they don't get Wonder Woman, or they don't really have anything, you know, like, they kind of were handed a bunch of other people's story moments that maybe they have a connection with and maybe they don't. So I think you're right, John, that it does kind of feel like they read coverage of these stories rather than, you know, reflecting on them in the way that the real writers of those characters would have.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because in the pages of 52 itself, I see kind of both sides of this equation. You've got all the stuff they did with Green Arrow in a couple of places. He's not a major character of 52, but I felt the scene where he gets the call from Firestorm or whatnot in issue 24 worked really well. It kind of set up where he was at in his timeline with the whole election and the mayor and all that kind of stuff, and we see him a few other times. It doesn't really take away from what's going on. It kind of plays into the big story. So I think had they chosen to continue down that road, they could have done kind of a deeper canvas, if you will, told the exact same stories they were telling with Montoya, with Black Adam, with all these others, and kind of take better use of the background, if you will.
Well,
and go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say that. I mean, had they had done that, they would have had too little space to do it.
I think they wasted space.
Okay.
Because if you look at some of the early issues, whenever we saw the newspaper clippings on T.O. Morrow's wall in Haven, there was text in those. Later issues, I mean, now granted, they were getting rushed, they had time constraints, whatever. It didn't have that level of depth in some of the panels. I certainly don't think that should have been in every panel, but I think they could have made better use, like I said, on our previous discussion, on newspaper headlines, radio stuff in the background, things that give us touch points and on the timeline of other characters without really stopping the various stories we had going on.
Yeah.
I think that's a great idea. And, you know, and I tell you, and I can only imagine from the outside point of view, you know, how much of an editorial nightmare the whole thing must have been to begin with. I mean, it was a grand party trick what they were already doing. But, I mean, in a perfect world, what I would love to have seen is exactly your idea, John. And then when it's time to fill in those newspaper headlines, for example, if it's Green Arrow, you have Judd Winnick do it. You know,
yeah.
Like, considering the fact that 52 was going to, and quickly, especially once it started selling the way it did, it was going to really lead the way through that year of continuity, and it had that year to itself, and it was going to, you know, be able to cast a light on all these other titles, some of which other people weren't reading. If you're the person who's writing, say, Aquaman, you know, wouldn't it behoove you to want to feature, even in an embedded way, even in an almost Easter egg kind of way like what you're describing, some little detail that makes somebody reading 52, who's going to take the time to really dig into that panel and look deeper, get intrigued about Aquaman, get intrigued about these other titles. And I really like that way of doing it, you know, adding it as a layer doesn't take away story pages. Because I'll say one thing, and I know Ian brought this up, you know, it already felt sometimes like they were so pressed for time that, you know, I sometimes resented it any moment that we tended to spend with, say, Bruce Wayne or something like that. It's like, yeah, he's got 1,000 comic books. Get me back to Animal Man. You know, it's like any point in which we took our eye off the cast. Mm-hmm. So your idea, John, I really like, because it's a way of essentially adding value, adding depth to panels that are already telling a foreground story. So you just kind of add subtext. Like anytime there's a TV screen, you know, I mean, it could have been something that could have been embedded into features in the back, you know, instead of a Dan DiDio column or something. You know, I mean, just like value is added on the 52 website with those fake news stories and things like that, move some of that into the comic if there's room for it. And then give it to the editors and writers of these books who could use that kind of bully pulpit to let you know what's going on in their books 1 year later. Let them fill in the content.
Well, do you feel that the change in editors halfway through might have had one of the reasons why we didn't get stuff like that? Because there was a distinct feeling that they might have been going for that in the first half, at least. You know, that they were trying to put as many details as possible in there. But with the editorial shakeup, you had a completely different editor with perhaps a different view on things come on in.
Like, for example, maybe it was Stephen Wacker that knew, like, what pub to ring up that you can get Brian Boland on the phone. And then Michael Sigling didn't have that number, so, you know, we never got that Joker origin.
Exactly.
It was like, Steve Wacker, he had this piece of paper in his wallet that had, I guess it was a cell phone number? I don't know. I think you're right. That, you know, if it wasn't the editorial shakeup, then probably just the stress of I'm sure time caught up with them. I mean, they got it all out on time, and that is no small thing. But probably once you got to the middle, they might have needed to get a little less ambitious about those extra layers, because probably the stress of it caught up.
When was that cutover of editors? I was thinking that was about halfway through, somewhere around issue 24-ish.
It was actually right about when we stopped talking about 52 the last time.
So about 22, okay.
Yeah.
Thereabouts, give or take.
Yeah, right
because,
about there.
I remember
noticing that Wacker's name was still credited for quite a few months after that, so clearly a number of issues were well in the can before Wacker's name came off the book and Sig Lane's went on.
Certainly. I would imagine they had H12 in various states of progress during that handoff.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And that handoff, I think, went very smoothly.
I mean,
the one thing I want to say on this is, I mean, everyone involved in 52, I think, deserves a round of applause. They did an awesome job.
Mm.
And, you know, Steve Wacker did a great job setting things up, getting things in motion, doing a smooth handoff to Sig Lane, who was able to pick it up and run with it. And I attribute a lot of that also to Keith Giffen, who kind of acted as the glue for the whole series.
Yeah,
certainly.
Well, you can't have better glue than Giffen.
Yeah.
There was a great interview with Giffen I'm trying to remember if it was with Giffen or if it was merely about Giffen, but in the most recent issue of, is it Danny Finger Office Right Now? I'm trying to remember the full name of that magazine. Right Now is the name of the magazine. The most recent issue has a number of articles about 52, and what really struck me was someone was reflecting on one of Giffen's most important pieces of input, which is that because he's the person that would do all the breakdowns, he would be, on some level, the first reader of all the scripts. You know, he would be that person outside of the editor that would get the scripts, and he was tended to be a person who was often catching little things or making suggestions like, oh, hey, you know, in this thing here, we could always have a callback to that thing 20 issues ago. You know, as the person who was delving into these scripts and reading them closely enough to create these breakdowns and this consistent look to then deliver to the artist, it was almost like he got to be the first person. I mean, not only did he contribute to the ideas, but also he was kind of that first person that read it as closely as a reader would, You know, it's like he kind of got to be the first audience member to really dig into it. And, you know, an audience member that knows comics like, you know, I mean, Keith Giffen does. I mean, has so much experience. So it just sounds like he ended up being able to be that filter. You know, he ended up being, I can only imagine some of the, you know, mistakes or little tweaks and twists that he ended up adding by being able to get the script in that vital point right before it actually started turning into art.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly was a focal point for the series creatively, between the writers, all the artists, the editors. And I think it gave it a unifying vision, which certainly helped.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and...
And I forget if I already brought this up on our prior conversation, but, you know, it's another piece of television storytelling that I think was put to good use. On television series, you know, your director of photography is often, you know, does a whole portion of a season. You know, I mean, some TV shows, you know, Homicide used one of the, you know, one guy for nearly all of the episodes, or as many as he could certainly do, and it was his visual style that informed things. You know, your directors in television come and go. You know, they're kind of guests in the house. And the consistent elements are the actors and the producers and often the DPs. So he got to do that. You know, I mean, I think it's no small reason why very few issues of 52 visually are distinct to the point where you kind of go, oh, that looks different. You know, for the most part, they kind of all flow together. I bet as a trade they'll really flow together, which is amazing considering how many artists were involved. And I think it's that, like on a TV show, you know, Giffen kind of got to set that look. You know, I mean, you set it up in the pilot and you repeat it so that every time you change the channel, you look and you go, oh, I know what I'm watching. I'm watching Homicide because the camera's moving this way and they're doing the jump cuts. You know, Giffen was able to do that. And I think it's great that on the trade, he's got cover credits. I mean, he certainly earns it right alongside the four writers as, you know, the group of storytellers that made that book what it was.
Oh, totally. He's so earned that. It's not even funny.
Yeah. Mm. And it's not only that, but I mean, literally having Giffen on the book is like having an extra editor right there. I mean,
yeah.
I mean,
An editor, a writer, and an artist. I mean, the guy has worn so many hats. He brought a lot to the table that be hard to think of very many other people who could have filled that role.
I can't off the top of my head. I really can't because I mean. Perhaps, you know, if he was a faster artist and could do breakdowns, you know, just like that, then possibly you could have maybe a George Perez might have been able to do it. But there certainly would have been a very different feel to 52 as a whole if there were Perez breakdowns, you know? With Giffen's style, it's so unique, and his voice is so unique that it just fit the entire series so perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A thing that I hope carries over from the success of 52 is, you know, it's no small thing to have that many egos in one room, in a sense. I mean, physically in a room sometimes, or, you know, creatively in a room week to week as they would collaborate. And, you know, from all accounts, they just complemented each other and got along so well, and there were never any big fights about where to take the story next. And it sounds like they just were able to, you know, as they often use the analogy, be a band about it.
Yeah.
And I hope that continues. I mean, I would love to think that, you know, in some cases, these are writers that have collaborated before. You know, Greg Rucka co-wrote Gotham Central with Ed Brubaker. I believe Mark Waid has co-written, Jeff Johns has co-written. I'm not sure whether Grant Morrison has in the past or not, but I would love to see more opportunities where writers team up, whether it be a team as large as this one, or even just more times where, you know, a really creative writer like Grant Morrison decides, you know what, I'd love to take on this other person over here and see what happens if we co-write. You know, that if enjoying the collaborative process is something that DC or other companies can use more often in the future. You know, by front-loading talent, it's just page by page, you just get more value for it.
I've got to think that Mark Waid's experience at CrossGen had to play into this in a large degree, because they had everybody there physically. They had, from what I hear, you know, meetings where, Waid would write Ruse or whatever, but then it had to go through the other writers to get, I don't want to say sanctified and blessed, but, you know, they would have their chance for input or whatever.
Really? You know, it's funny, I'd heard a lot about CrossGen as far as the artistic sort of bullpen, but I didn't realize that the writers were on the property as well.
Yeah, that was actually one of the things that I think led to why Waid left, because writers, by their nature, are kind of, you know, solitary individuals, them and their keyboard, you know?
No, I don't mean shifty.
No, it just seems like from some of the things I've read, whether they're true or not, I don't know, that while I think it was a good experience for Wade in many respects, I think CrossGen also had a lot of things that didn't sit well with him in terms of the nature of the way the company was run, the collaborative, you know, some of the creative decisions, whatever. So I think he may have gone into something like 52, you know, with his eyes open, and it would not surprise me at all if he had been very upfront about, you know, here are the things that could go wrong, let's avoid them.
Well, and plus, wasn't he also a part of Action Comics Weekly? I mean, that wasn't exactly a success, but am I remembering it right that he was a part of that team?
Ooh, I would imagine so, but I can't, I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
But he's also one who was...
Because that came up in his exit interview that Newsarama did with him.
Okay.
I don't know what his position was on it, whether he was writing or editing, but I believe he was definitely involved.
Yeah, and I was just to say, he was an editor before, so,
yeah.
I mean, he's got kind of the big picture mentality also.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good point, John, about this, you know, I mean, writers are, I mean, and even, you know, good friends of mine that are writers and playwrights and things, I mean, writers are and need to be incredibly protective of their ideas and their work. And, you know, and it's tough because when you're in school as a writer, you know, the kind of the class environment, the workshop environment can be really caustic and hard. And, you know, and there's often when writing is taught formally that notion where, you know, you're kind of having to write by committee with everybody commenting on your work and things like that. So I do think that in fields that where writers are usually very singular, which is certainly the case for most playwrights and is for the usually the case in comics, there's probably going to be a lot of natural defensiveness. And it was great to see that some of these writers who may not have collaborated often before or maybe hadn't in a long time were able to make a go of it. You know, it's again getting back to, you know, borrowing from television. I mean, television for, you know, decades, I mean, I pretty much since it started, would write in rooms. You know, you'd assemble a room full of writers, and, you know, they're famously contentious because you've got a group of people all playing make-believe together. I mean, it's pretty much, you know, it's like Calvin Ball. You know, it's like you get a group of kids together, and you have to decide what the rules are, and you have to come to firm agreements about fiction. Like, no, yeah. The rules are this and such, and he shoots blue things out of his eyes, you know, and things like that. I mean, it's kind of a big game of make-believe,
yeah.
But you have to get a group of adults, all of whom have, for all these years, honed their skills and, of course, are going to be defensive of their work and characters and things like that, and you have to get them to kind of agree upon a fiction together. And I think the fact that they pulled that off is impressive, and I hope it only leads to that much more collaboration and team writing. I mean, right now, Greg Rucka and Judd Winnick have a great crossover going with Checkmate and the Outsiders.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I'd just love to see if that, you know, everybody that had that 52 experience suddenly ends up being, you know, kind of regular collaborators with other peers of theirs.
Well, I think it actually goes the other way. I think that having had good collaboration before is what led to 52 working. Because I think Greg Rucka, Jeff Johns, and Judd Winnick are all close friends and hang out together or whatever,
yeah.
From what I've heard. Mm-hmm. So between that, between all being good writers and a mutual admiration society kind of thing, I would imagine going, you know, I think at least, you know, Rucka and Johns came into this with a, you know, I've worked with other people, I can do that, we can do make this work attitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, you've got some of the best writers in comics on this series. If you had taken lesser talent or less sociable talent, maybe might be the right word in some cases, you could have had four brilliant writers that were so egotistical they couldn't possibly work together, and this would have been a complete train wreck.
Oh, of course.
Maybe a brilliantly written one, but it could have easily gotten sidetracked by the behind-the-scenes shenanigans,
yeah,
too.
Sure. Yeah,
absolutely. I think a thing that spoke well for the fact that the project was going to work out was the fact that, you know, and whether they made this decision as a group before they spoke to, you know, podcasts and things like that, or whether it just happened naturally, I really enjoyed that in early interviews, none of the writers would kind of come out and say who was writing what. Like, a lot of people were scratching around trying to say, now, Greg Rucka, come on, you know, the Montoya question, that's your stuff, isn't it? You know, like,
sure.
Everybody was scratching around trying to figure out who wrote what, and they were usually really reticent to answer those questions. And to me, I would read that or hear that and think, good, you know, that's being an ensemble. You know, ensemble is a word that we use in theater a lot, but it's that sense of, you know, being able to share the stage so that, you know, it's not about your moment outshining everything else. It's not about making a scene that you're in be about you over here, even though you're the servant or whatnot. You know, it's just about going, no, we're just this team. This incredible thing comes out of the group of us, and I'm not going to break it down into who wrote what. We all wrote all of it, you know, and that's just a really great answer that I think is spoke well for how they were getting along, as opposed to, you know, yeah, I mean, the kind of hypothetical that you're talking about, you know, if they weren't getting along, somebody would be desperate to know, no, Black Adam is mine, and that's why it's not rubbish like that thing over there, you know?
That would have or this mistake is all his fault. Or, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
His tights were blue, all because he said it was blue. I told him it was red, damn it, but he wouldn't listen. Yeah. But also, one of the things that I really enjoyed in the interview specifically was that a lot of the writers, specifically, if I remember correctly, Morrison and Wade both actually mentioned this in their Newsarama interviews, that whenever they would hit a snag, whenever they would get some sort of writer's block, the other writers were there to give them inspiration to get out of it. And that's not something you get when you're writing something yourself. I mean, and it's so many writers have had this happen to them before, and they don't have people to turn to help them out of it, but that's the situation that we had here with 52. If you couldn't write a Montoya scene, then somebody else said, oh, well, how about she does this? And right away, bam, things get started, and before you know it, it's written.
But again, I think that goes back to the personalities involved. You know, they were one willing to ask for help, willing to listen to it, and they all had each other's back on this, and the whole thing is so much stronger because of it.
Definitely. Yeah, no, and I mean, I'll agree with that just because of the fact that, again, because you said that these guys are friends because they have collaborated in the past and know how to collaborate, that's the most important thing. And I think they learned something here from this experience that you can be a great writer, but when you have a great writer backing up a great writer, the story's going to be even better.
Yeah.
And they learned that, you know, Mark Wade is a little shifty. I made that up. I've got nothing to say.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
I wonder whether... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
The time pressure, you know, often when you're under pressure for time, when you're writing to deadline, you know, a lot of creativity can come out of that. I mean, I wonder, too, in the moment that you're describing where, you know, you're stuck and you can ring up everyone else, when you're up against those deadlines, it all becomes problem solving. You know, like there's almost no time for ego because it's got to, you know, everybody's got to get this thing done and everybody's got to get their pieces together. So I wonder, too, if that's a part of what kept everybody from having to be so protective or be so perfectionist is that, you know, a lot of writers romanticize.
Time to fight.
Exactly. You know, a lot of writers romanticize, you know, the pulp era where, you know, you were paid whatever it was, you know, a penny a word and you had to get the book out a month or, you know, I mean, the schedules that those writers used to keep. And, you know, there's something to be said for that feverish pace. You know, there's times where, you know, once comics became things that could come out whenever, you know, and didn't have to be done to deadline. And, you know, I think sometimes people get a little too precious about, you know, crafting each and every little bit, both on the writing side and the art side. I think there was something great about their refusal for this to be delayed, you know, that they just, it seems like they made a decision that no matter what happened, this thing was going to come out on time. And I wonder if, for some of them, it was a new experience, you know, of just going, you know what, it's, you know, it's that old adage in art that, you know, it's never finished, it's just abandoned. So I wonder if there were some weeks where they went, you know what, I'd love to re-dialogue everything, but that's it, it goes.
Yeah.
And, you know, being able to walk away and get to the next week might have been an exciting experience for them.
I mean, Mark Wade has his run on The Flash. I don't recall any huge major delays. Rucka being, you know, a novel writer in a lot of his books, again, not somebody known for delays.
Other than Queen and Country. But I think that's more of a marketplace decision than anything else.
Exactly. You know, you look at his work on, I'm going to say Gotham Central, I'm going to say Wonder Woman. I mean, I'd have to go look up, you know, did some of these under his tenure have delays or not, but... I mean, these are guys that, you know, had the not only the talent but also the discipline to be getting stuff out on a monthly basis. And so, I mean, certainly the fact that they got 52 issues out in 52 weeks is a monumental undertaking and, an amazing achievement. But, I mean, you're going to, you know, I would think from DC's point of view, pick writers that you think can do this to begin with. and certainly I think all of the ones they had were getting not only very talented, but very disciplined and very aware of, you know, things shouldn't ship late in general. And I'm sure you're right that this took on a bigger proportion after the Civil War fiasco and things like that.
Oh, sure. And plus, I mean, because you did what you did with 52, if one specific week were to be late, you would have had to hold up probably certain parts of the line, just like you had to hold up things for Civil War. Because
no, I think they would have just shipped two the next week.
Yeah, you think?
Although it would have...
If it was only 1 week.
Okay.
That's true.
Yeah.
And the but it certainly, by not being late, they got to sort of, you know, they got to disappoint those people that I think had tuned in to the car race for the car crash. You know, I mean, I'm sure there were some people that just, you know, had vowed, oh, they'll never do it, and they were just waiting. You know, they were able to disappoint the cynics on that point.
Well, I think even if they had had an artist who, you know, a week before he was supposed to turn in something, you know, suddenly, you know, not only disappeared off the face of the planet, but took all of his art with him or something, I think they would have been able to pull in enough artists to get something that looked good, and maybe, you know, every page was done by a different artist or every two or three pages, I think they would have been able to bring the resources to bear to keep the train running on time.
Sure.
Well, were there any artists in particular on 52 that you felt did not suit the style that they could have possibly went somewhere else to get the art done? Because there were a couple issues here and there that really didn't feel like they really meshed with the rest, as it were. And I'm thinking off the top of my head, Derek Robertson and Phil Jimenez's issues, to be specific.
The one that comes to mind is the one that had the big reveal with Ralph in 42.
Yeah.
That's Robertson, yeah.
But I couldn't tell if that was art style, time pressure, or what that was. But that was one of the ones that I read thinking, you know, the art's not working for me.
Yeah. And, I mean, again, because it was so different than the other stuff as well. I mean, when you had guys like, say, Giustiniano and, you know, Bennett that have styles that are similar enough where if you were to put them all on something that lasts 52 weeks, it'd be hard to distinctly tell the difference between one or the other. And then you have a guy who has a very, very distinct style like Derek Robertson coming in there. You're going to see some disjointedness with the art. It didn't happen often. But just certain artists that they chose to do a specific week with didn't really mesh too well with me.
I was going to say Todd Nock is another one that I think has a very distinctive style.
Yeah.
And I thought his issue, which I think was 13, but I could be wrong, showed, you know, it was very much his style, his flavor, whatever, but still fit in with everything else that was going on.
Sure, exactly, yeah. Yeah, and I didn't feel that nearly as much with Phil Jimenez. And I love Phil Jimenez's art. I always do. But Phil Jimenez's art was not meant for 52. It stood out. And 52
is a more realistic style. I would agree with that.
Exactly.
Yeah. I guess it didn't bother me so much, partly because the issue that he did was that Justice League issue, you know, sort of the substitute Justice League.
Yeah.
And there was just something, you know, and we'd had, if memory serves, we'd had a number of not very action-packed issues in a row. So when that one hit, and there was, you know, a lot of action in it, and it was this Justice League, I don't know, there was just something polished about it that stylistically worked for me. You know, like, there was just, you know, right on down to, you know, you had this kind of propaganda poster for the cover, and then the rest of the art kind of, it almost felt like, for 1 week, the book had kicked into, you know, the authority mode or something like that. I don't know, that sort of worked for me, although the Derek Robertson stuff, not so much. I mean... Portions of that Ralph story, Robertson's artwork worked very well with. I mean, the kind of big parlor scene that Ralph pulls in the tower, you know, because in Robertson, particularly with that anchor, reminds me a lot of the early Sam Keith stuff from Sandman.
Uh-huh.
So it kind of brought me right back. I was like, suddenly I was reading, you know, late 80s, you know, fantasy sort of stuff. So, the magic portions were great, but then there was a point where the issue inevitably left Ralph and looked in on some other storyline, and I felt like I almost didn't even recognize the characters. So in that sense, as much as Robertson was a gain for the ending of the Ralph storyline, he probably wasn't a very good fit as an issue of 52. And then I think Robertson did another one later on that didn't really feel like it fit at all.
And
it looked
completely different than the previous one. It looked completely different because you could tell he was a lot further rushed on that second issue he did in the first one.
Maybe he was angry. It was like the day where they told him that Boys was cool. They're like, now draw 52. You're exclusive. Get in the room. And they just sort of threw him into the whatever exclusive artist dungeon.
Yeah.
And there you go. You know, so yeah, maybe there was a little bit of anger to it. Or maybe it's a different anger. I don't know.
It's funny because there were so many artists involved that, you know, there was enough meshing of style and flavor, both because of Giffen and because of the various artists and stuff, that I thought overall, you know, with, again, the one or two exceptions we've talked about, it flowed very smoothly.
Yeah.
It was never – because I read through the whole thing this weekend, and there was never any point where I'm sitting there thinking, damn, you know, what the hell happened to the art? But because there were so many artists involved, you know, I kind of have to give – you know, the series a little bit more slack than I would if it was one artist who done the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because one thing I noticed was certain people, when they come back from issue to issue and the characters are, you know, in the series, their costume is different.
Huh.
Now, sometimes it's subtle stuff like Booster's goggles keep changing style from artist to artist.
Well, you know, the season kept changing.
Yeah,
this
was his winter goggles. These were his summer goggles.
It's like, wow, those goggles were so spring. I'm on my summer goggles now.
Yeah, but
well, with that marketing decision, you know, time for the new one.
That's right.
But the one character, and I can chalk this up as just, hey, it's magic, whatever. That I really noticed the biggest costume changes on was Captain Marvel.
Uh-huh.
He had three distinct costumes during the course of the series that I noticed.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, they all fit the basic, he's got the red suit with the lightning bolt and the cape kind of thing. But one of them had a huge lightning bolt that started at the top of the collar, covered most of the chest. Another time it was the more smaller standard size. And then another one, it was the tunic or whatever that has kind of the flap, like it's a wraparound coat kind of a deal. Mm. I mean, these aren't
and
big deals.
And there was a time that he accessorized with the fanny pack. That was just really embarrassing.
Yeah, well, we don't talk about that, you know?
Yeah. Everybody just tried not to look.
Grandma Marvel.
I mean, these are the kinds of things, though, that with a series this big, this many characters, and certainly this many artists, is going to happen. And the fact that it never once, at least in my opinion, kind of got to the point where it impeded the story, I was very pleased with that.
Mm. As
so now, John, as you mentioned, John, so this weekend, and I was jealous. I mean, what a fun adventure it must have been. You reread the entire 52.
Yes.
What was that like? I mean, I'm just curious what that experience was like, you know, compared to having read them weekly, or, you know, what's that journey of sitting down and reading the whole thing through, like, one novel?
It's a really long story. It's like 1,080 pages. So I'm not going to claim I did it in one sitting. My bladder is not
in fact,
that good.
You changed goggles several times before you finished.
I felt 52 years older, that's for sure. What I did is I started at the beginning and just went all the way through and kind of stopped every 13th issue because that's where they seem to be doing the trade
breaks.
Paperback.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And you had commented in a private message we had exchanged about wondering how that would kind of compartmentalize the story and whatnot.
Sure.
And it worked really well. I mean, they had to know going in that they were going to package this in four, you know, essentially quarterly installments, if you will.
And I'd hoped that they'd done that they'd planned act breaks that way.
Yeah. I would be amazed if this happened by accident.
Yeah.
It seems so intentional. Because end of 13, we get the big bit with Ralph and the failed resurrection. You know, various characters are at you know, clean stopping points, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not an end to their story, but kind of a, you know, we're going to get a new beginning almost on the next thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and it did really feel like that, even though you were working with the same characters. You had different situations going, different emotions being felt by the characters, and different points in their life, because literally, over the course of a year, how could you not change? Everybody changes, even in subtle ways. And the story does that so well throughout the 52 issues, where you have characters, specifically Montoya, where you see the evolution coming from, you know, drunk and hopeless to finding a friend to then losing a friend and finding herself in the end. And you've got those different chapters going on where you see everything going through. And the other characters, same sort of thing. So it's something that had to be done in the course of 52 for 52 to work right.
Now, what's interesting is I think there are a couple of characters and storylines that you can go, I think, an entire trade paperback without having anything to do with.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, the whole Oolong Island, you know, doesn't really come into being until, that was what, issue 22 or whatever. There are a few things that kind of set it up in the first 13 issues, but at that point, it looks more like Magnus is just a supporting character in Booster's story.
Yeah.
Than having his own, or, you know, yeah, at that point, Booster's. You know, I think they did a good job in terms of the big level, you know, segmentation and arcs of, for the story. I still go back to having a few quibbles with, it seems like a number of issues could go between characters even showing up.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, you know, 2 months would go by. And it's, oh yeah, we've got this other character over here we need to bring back.
Yeah.
It was less of an issue when I read it all at once, just because, you know, I could usually remember. It's like, oh yeah, 4 hours ago when I read this, that's where the guy was. And it took most of the day. Go ahead.
Were there any threads that went nowhere? I mean, threads that you really felt like this was something they meant to get back to?
You really want one of those cookies, don't you?
Let's go ahead and dive into this. I mean,
this goes back.
Chocolate chip. They're very good. Very good.
Okay.
I mean, go ahead. No, it's fair. I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not trying to keep you from saying it.
Well,
no,
I just want a cookie.
You know,
I just want to have a cookie while I listen to it. That's,
go have a cookie as I get into this.
All right.
It goes back to the expectation of, were they going to fill in all the gaps for 1 year later? I had hoped initially that they would touch on a lot of that stuff. I certainly didn't expect them to cover all of it, because I was hoping that with the 1 year later, we would get a sense of discovery in the DC universe that would keep going and not just thump, here are the answers, let's move on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've commented on this on the forums and gotten various feedback or whatever. There are certain things that I feel were set up in the 1 year later titles and should have been addressed there, and in some cases were, some cases were not. There are other things that I think were entirely set up in 52 and as such should have been dealt with in 52.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole bit of Alan Scott having lost an eye. Okay, that was set up in Checkmate.
Sorry, hold on. Right, go on. They're a day or two old now, but then it kind of becomes like the cookie dough and the ice cream, that they're, ooh, just a little more chewy. I'm sorry, continue. Alan Scott's eye.
Okay, but,
member
but
of
him
the
losing
space,
the eye was set up
hero.
In Checkmate and in JSA Classified, and I think even in JSA. So, okay, arguably that should have been taken care of in those other titles. The fact that he lost both and had somebody else's all in 52. But the one that really got me was Hawkgirl.
Mm.
The mystery
yes.
set up for her in Hawkgirl 50 at the beginning of 1 year later is, where's Hawkman? Now, they finally, you know, dealt with that in the pages of Hawkgirl, as they should have. We're starting to get a little bit more of that in Justice League of America.
Mm.
But in issue 4 and 5, you've got the big kind of quasi-cliffhanger at the end of 4 of the injured space heroes are back, so go have another cookie. And then in 5, most of the issue is dealing with them. And this is where we find out for the first and only time that Hawkgirl is suddenly 25 feet big.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, they're doing stuff here. And to me, that, along with Alan Scott's missing eyes, I'm thinking, okay, he's missing eyes. Eyes suddenly could be, you know, scaled up to, you know, whatever a 25-foot person's eyes would be. Gosh, that seems familiar, like the the Emerald Eye of Ekron from the Emerald Empress of the Legion of Superheroes, their villains, which sure enough comes into play later.
Yeah.
So for that whole storyline to go nowhere was disappointing.
Now, and I apologize because I'm chewing, but we did, didn't we, at Christmas, we got some bit where, like, we take, you know, like, hot girls off her crutches or something.
Yeah, but it was one
piece. Yeah, she was never on crutches.
Yeah.
Well, sure, when you shrink, I know from personal experience, when one is shrunk from 25 feet, it's hell on your calves.
I guess so,
now,
yeah.
So you need
it's
to be on crutches for a short while.
That whole thing was in issue 33. All of those scenes take place on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Christmas
Day.
Huge
banner. There's a big banner that said, Merry Christmas, John Mayo and Jamie D. Love. Love
actually,
the healing space heroes.
I thought Christmas was one of the most disappointing days of the series.
Kind of was. Yeah, no, you're right.
Because, I mean, what we got
Christmas
on Hawkgirl, a single panel.
I know.
Yeah.
But it is still something. I mean, to be fair, and I know I'm being, you know, I'm being pedantic at this point, but, I mean, it's not clearly, because it wasn't satisfying to you, it clearly wasn't enough. But it is something. So it's not so much that the story went nowhere. I mean, it's like Keith Giffen, actually, in talking about Blue Beetle, you know, he said this in a few interviews, you know, in comics, a character can come back in one panel. You know, like in comics, you can resurrect somebody in one panel, they walk through the door and they say, I got better, or something like that. Now, no one says that's a really satisfying way to resurrect someone, just like no one saying, hey, look, Hawk Girl's off her crutches is at all a satisfying way of resolving, but it is something of a resolution. I mean, you know, and I think later she had some throwaway line, too, so it's not great, but it
in World War
they were acknowledging.
Yeah,
well, in World War III, it basically references back here of, gosh, I'm glad I saw Dr. Midnight 6 months ago or whatever.
Yeah.
So I mean,
yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. This is not stellar storytelling,
sure.
But it did cover the base, however haphazardly. It did sort of weakly check that off.
And I disagree with that. And the reason I disagree with that is I feel that those single panel things, they don't tell a story at all. They certainly don't give us any information other than what we can see visually in the single panel. Of, okay, she's seeing Dr. Midnight, she no longer needs crutches. To me, that's not moving a story along, that's not progressing something, it's not payoff in any way, shape, or form. And there were a number of cases in 52 where, and, you know, to a degree, I almost have to blame Giffen on this, where the storytelling was just flat out unclear.
Yeah.
The whole Supernova takes a tour of the Batcave.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't,
although, you know, when I reread that and I knew that Supernova was in there shopping for, he was in there to steal tech, it suddenly did make a lot more sense. Like, I remember we talked about that page when we were trying to figure out Supernova, and it was really confusing because when you first read it, it makes the moment where he looks at the Robin costume seem like that's the point, like he's meditating on dead Robin. Whereas then when you reread it, knowing that he's just in the cave to kind of pilfer stuff, you kind of notice, oh, he sort of looks at the one object, then he looks at the Robin costume, and then the scene ends when he looks at the glove thingy that he steals.
It comes down to the second reading,
it worked, but in the first reading, I agree, the pacing of it gave you the wrong idea. It made you go, oh,
the reason it works
Robin.
On that
Supernova knows Robin, you know?
The reason it works on that second reading is because you're able to read things into the scene.
Exactly.
Right, sure.
Yeah. And I mean,
the scene itself doesn't tell us what arguably it should be telling us.
Yeah, and that's not the way that you should really go about anything, because it really shouldn't have to take a second read to find out things like that. Because when I saw that the first time around, I got to thinking, could that be Jason Todd in there? You know, I mean, is this like, you know, Dick Grayson from Earth 2 going on here? Because they seem to spend so much time. And again, sure, it was only one panel, but why even bother looking at that Robin costume in the first place? It took me completely away from it. And, you know,
well, it tells you that you're in the Batcave.
Yeah, but that's it. I mean, you could have told by the giant penny. The giant penny would have told you the same
thing. The bigger problem with that scene isn't that he went and looked at other things. It's that we never actually saw him take the glove.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure.
They could have had a different scene later on and had it be, you know, him confirming that Jason Todd was dead on this earth. Or, you know, they could have played anything else. Out of that scene that we could have then gone back and read the right thing into. you know,
no, I take your point. Although it also, and this again might just be a difference in what it was that each of us wanted from it. You know, I mean, the difference between wanting to be surprised versus, you know, say Fair Play Mystery, which is that, you know, had he taken the glove, what maybe too much of Supernova's thing would have been revealed right then. You know, maybe we're not meant to actually know what Supernova was doing in that cave. Maybe that page was, when you first read it, meant to just thicken the plot, you know, meant to just intensify the Supernova mystery. I mean, for all of us that were tracking that mystery on the board, I remember the week that issue came out, all of us were suddenly thrown. It was like, wait a minute. All the people, you know, because again, all of us were kind of, it's like everybody's holding like a ticket to the lottery, and the people with the Starman ticket go, "What? Wait a minute, Starman 1 million doesn't know, what is he doing in the Batcave?" You know, I'm thinking, does Mr. Gold know where the Batcave is? You know, like all of us are kind of, you know, so
couldn't
to me,
they
that
have...
page was about stirring the pot, going, you think,
no,
you know,
and I agree with that.
Well, what if he's somebody that knows where the Batcave is? Suddenly everybody goes, what? You know, I don't know.
And I agree that leaving the mystery, building the mystery and stuff is a good thing. Mm. I think they went so far in the completely ambiguous area that they failed to do that. If we had seen him take the glove, it's, oh, wow, he's robbing the Batcave. Maybe he's not on the up and up. I mean, you know, does he know Batman? Does he not? How did he know the glove was there? Did he not? I mean, there are a lot of aspects of the mystery that they could have tossed in there. As it was, I think myself and a lot of other people were left just kind of scratching our head thinking, okay, what happened here?
Yeah.
He was in the Batcave.
But sometimes
he looked around.
Sure. But rather, I mean, but it may be, I guess what I'm getting at is that rather than, we don't know what the page was meant to be doing, maybe it was the intention, and it's valid if you don't like this intention, but maybe the intention was to make everybody scratch their head. You know, as
opposed I try not to
informing
go...
what Supernova was up to, because it wasn't so much later, I think, that we know that he's stealing tech at all. I mean, it was shortly before we knew who it was.
Well, it was the issue before.
That we even know that we're, exactly. So, you know, it's like, it was, you know, that might, maybe that's too big of a clue. Once we know that that he doesn't have superpowers, then in fact, he's patching together all this tech. I don't know. I mean, I guess the only part of your, I mean, I agree entirely that if you didn't like it, that's absolutely fair. I guess the one part of your premise I don't necessarily disagree with was that it failed at something. Because maybe it did exactly what they wanted it to do.
Well, and again, I agree. Not knowing what their intent was, I can't say that it failed in their intent. What I can say...
Because we probably know the instructions to Giffen was make sure that they get baffled by this, you know?
Well, true. It's entirely possible. It just seems that the way they marketed the series... the way they set certain aspects of the story up, it was with a come play along and see if you can figure it out with the characters attitude.
And that didn't do anything for that. Yeah.
Yeah, no,
and
that's fair.
Particularly, have you solved the mystery? When I saw that ad and they were, you know, had the various images and stuff, the first question I had is what were the mysteries? You know, but then the second one was, you know, it's like, okay, if you want to tell us a storyline is a mystery, and they flat out did that with Ralph's storyline, I have certain expectations that if I pay attention, if I read along, if I think about it and really, you know, put some work into it, I at least have a chance of figuring out the mystery.
Yeah.
And in most of the major reveals, I felt that they had, you know, withheld either some key clue or evidence or whatever, or something came so far out of left field that while it was still a decent payoff and a well-executed payoff in terms of emotional satisfaction, intellectually I was left wanting. I was left feeling, oh, what the hell? There was no way I could have figured that out. You didn't tell me any of the things I needed to know to get some of this going.
And then there was certain stuff that we didn't really get answers for. Like, for instance, why the hell were the space heroes as important to things as they were? Because, I mean, we still do not have all the answers with the space heroes. Now, mind you, the space heroes in themselves was left dangling in the first place from Infinite Crisis. Now, 52 weeks later, it takes another miniseries for us to find out the truth behind the space heroes, because that's what I expect is probably going to be happening in this new series that they're going to be coming out with. I think it's Palmiotti writing it. That, I mean, we couldn't get their full answers in 52 issues. Sure, they're back.
I thought we did. I thought we got it both in 52, and I think we got some of it in Countdown 51.
Okay.
Granted, that's still another series.
Yeah, but what do you guys think it is? Because to me,
they saw the 52 worlds.
They did. Okay. All right.
They saw the creation of the Megaverse.
Okay.
They saw the 412 walls of the universe.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and only Red Tornado was the one who could map it, which is why his head became so important. I take your point, though, Ian, and I think that the answer is that they're kind of another leftover from the point where 52, where the characters were going to be the guides rather than the point.
Uh-huh.
That I think that, you know, their initial idea with, you know, Buddy and Starfire and Adam Strange were, oh, we've got these people stranded out in space. On their way back, we're going to meet Lady Styx, and she's going to be important later, and we're going to see Lobo, and we're going to, you know, I think that they may have begun going, oh, and we'll kind of have this story, and it'll be like Homer's Odyssey, and on their way home, that'll be our tour of the DC Cosmos, and then they'll make it home.
Yeah.
At the point where it went from being, you know, a guidebook to a real story, I think that that plot line was left a little rudderless. Like, what was disappointing to me about it was, I mean, parts of that journey were great, parts of it were really muddled. I mean, it involved my favorite character, but there were points where I kept expecting their arrival to be in the nick of time to matter.
Yeah.
And their arrival, beyond just being happy, oh, buddy's home, he made it, beyond being happy, there's nothing to it. Like, I expected that he was going to be the messenger who just barely makes it in time to warn everybody of the impending danger or this or that. And that ended up not being the case at all. I mean, the only piece that they needed was, you know, Red Tornado's head that was already there.
Tornado's head, to a degree, was a MacGuffin. He's got something, everybody needs it, and it's got the magic thing they needed in 52.
Right.
You know.
Yeah,
but
leaving what Buddy and Starfire and Adam saw and did kind of pointless.
Exactly.
Story.
Yeah.
I think that their whole storyline, while aspects were almost enjoyable, it was certainly the weakest of the whole bunch.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't for having interesting characters, plot-wise, it was very disappointing.
Yeah. Mm. And I mean, especially considering the fact that, I mean, again, like you said, it was the characters that drove it. These were characters that I wanted to know more about. I've read Starfire in the past, however, I never really got that much of an idea for her past the fact that she's, you know, she's from Tamaran, she used to be a princess. That's what I know about her, really. Animal Man, I've read the first volume of his trade paperback. I know he's a great character. That's it. Adam Strange, same thing. And instead, they really, all they did was bond. I liked the bonding, but I really didn't see much growth in their characters from their adventure out there.
Yeah. I mean, I will say and this is the thing I meant to bring up earlier, that I believe does effectively unite all the stories like a novel, even though plot-wise they don't all connect together. They did have a moment where they did fit the theme, at least, and that's one thing that I'd say was a real strength of 52, is I felt like they had a really clear theme that all the stories stuck to. I would articulate it as the question of, you know, what makes a hero? You know, that so many of these plot lines can be boiled down into moments, whether they be inexperienced characters becoming heroes for the first time, like Montoya, or becoming a different kind of hero, or really experienced characters giving up something they want to stand up and be a hero. You know, Ralph almost throws away his chance to be with Sue to stand up to Faust. Buddy and Starfire and Adam, on the brink of being able to make it home, decide to stop and make a kind of suicide mission of standing up to Lady Styx, because that's what heroes do. So I feel like thematically they found a way to fit them in, but, you know, plot-wise, and on some level, I'll agree, character growth-wise, that wasn't a huge arc.
Yeah.
You know, because for the most part, they are, I mean, certainly Adam Strange and Starfire are already heroes. We think that Buddy is, although it's kind of muddy as to whether is he the retired guy from Vertigo, or is he kind of active again, like, I'm sure if they set out from the beginning knowing the story that they were going to write, they either would have put somebody else out there with them that had more to learn and do and grow, or they would have probably just not spent so much time on that story, they would have kind of brought them straight home or something. I do feel like that was something where they kind of got around to it in whatever week that was, 8 or 9, and kind of went, oh, okay, what are we going to do with this now? You know, and it was pretty mixed results.
And am I the only one who feels it was sort of a cop-out to give Adam Strange his eyes back?
Well, again, that was a whole plot line. It's like, well, that went nowhere.
Exactly. Yeah, because, I mean, that was one of the few things I actually felt was true character growth. The fact that Adam Strange was learning to deal with his, you know, his blindness, that he was learning to understand that he's still a hero even though he can't see, and that he was going to learn new ways to be what he already was, but instead he just gets his eyes back at the end.
But that's not the only story they did that with. They did the same thing with Natasha.
Yeah.
Now, while she goes through the character progression and learns to take responsibility and to try and earn her stuff, the armor she's in at the end is the one that her uncle built her.
Yeah.
So the whole bit of him disassembling it and whatever, it's like, I don't want to say it was all for naught, because I thought she got a decent character arc, but it kind of undercut it at the end there.
Although, wasn't there some... I thought there was some line where before, I don't know if it was before World War III, where there was some bit where, like, they're kind of back together and they're happy and everything, and she's saying, oh, I've got to go work on my armor some more. I thought there was some line that made it feel like their new status quo is the one in which she stays in and, like, recalibrates the boot jets. Certainly.
There was a bit at the end where she was doing a shakedown thing on it, and it's like, oh, it needs a little work.
Yeah.
John's like, oh, I'll take care of it. She's like, no, my responsibility. So she got the character arc.
Yeah.
And she grew, but she still didn't build her own damn armor.
Oh, well.
You know what I mean?
That's true. Well, maybe part of it was that, you know, John had to learn to mellow out as well. I mean, I don't know. I guess the idea didn't bother me so much. I mean, I felt like she'd gone through.
I'm not saying it was a fatal flaw or anything of the sort. It weakened the story a little.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. And it's because of the skill of execution between the writers and the artists on this that even with all the flaws I did see, it was still a very good story, very well-told story, more so than we had any right to expect.
Yeah, it was still my top-of-the-stack book every single time.
Absolutely.
I went to the store. Even if there were parts that I wasn't, you know, 100% for, it was still the first book I read every single week. And there is not one book now that, whenever it comes out, it will always be my first book. 52 was always the first book I read every single week when I got back from the store. That says something.
Yeah, and the one that you really felt like you had no idea what was going to happen.
Exactly, yeah.
And when you consider that this is still the past, I mean, that you were reading, you know, a year behind a lot of the other books you were reading from DC, that's no small thing. You know, like the fact that it could feel like it was at the leading edge of sort of what was happening. And that it could get you to care about, in some cases, characters that really weren't that important to people. I mean, I find it hilarious in the most recent solicitations that were posted that, you know, they're kind of spicing up solicitations by saying, like, such and such issue guest starring Animal Man. It's like, I tell you, a year and a half ago, that would have been a joke. You know, that'd be like, and guess who Ambush Bug's going to come on by? You know, like,
it's
I mean, that's like sales death. So it's so fun to see suddenly, like, new marquee value being given to some of these characters that, you know, they got such a boost.
Now you get to see Justice League alum Ambush Bug. So.
I know, huh?
You know, it's funny because a lot of times over the year I would hear people saying, oh, these are Z-list heroes, they're nobodies, they're, you know, whatever. A lot of the characters that were the key characters in 52 are not, I'm not going to say never were nobodies. If anything, they were has-beens.
Yeah.
A lot of them had been, you know, lead characters in the series.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
You know, less so with Black Adam, but only because he was a villain to a degree.
Mm.
Isis, you could argue, although it was a different Isis, had her own series back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Different version of Batwoman had one. Certainly The Question was a headliner. You could argue Montoya and Gotham Central.
Mm-hmm.
Will Magnus with the Metal Men and stuff.
Yeah.
And really out of the Oolong Island, probably he's the only one there. But again, most of those are villains. Villains usually don't get their own titles. Booster Gold had his own series. Rip Hunter had his own series. Ralph had a mini series and has been a mainstay of the Justice League. So certainly not a, you know, who is this guy?
Not enough backup stories to fill the showcase.
True. Good point. I'd forgotten about that. Excellent point. Dr. Fate in various incarnations has had numerous titles and a backup feature in The Flash at one point. Lex Luthor has had a few miniseries. Steel had his own title. You know, Adam Strange had his own title.
Had his own title.
Yeah. Animal Man
Lobo
had a long running. I mean,
yeah.
These are not nobody characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, as you put it, they were ones that had fallen out of favor. I mean, they're kind of toys that had slipped to the bottom of the box that, you know, could use that boost. And I think what, you know, I especially felt this when we saw the Ted Kord Blue Beetle moment in issue 52, that it hit me that there were a lot of great geek-out moments for those of us that have a lot of love for DC in the 80s, you know, in the kind of just shortly after the original Crisis 80s, because I think that a lot of the people that got featured in 52 were ones that were being published at that time. You know, I mean, that was back when O'Neill was doing his Question series and Booster Gold was running and, you know, and the Giffen DeMatteis League was running. I mean, there was a lot of love for those properties, you know, the ones that kind of DC got away from in particularly the mid to late 90s, and this is a chance to kind of go back and rediscover what can be great about those characters, that those characters can still have a place and can still work.
Well, and how often, short of a major reboot with one of the best writers and artists in, you know, say, the world, can you get D-list superheroes that, you know, perhaps used to be big but now aren't, who are almost immediately, after everything is all said and done, boosted up to the status of A or B list to many people? I mean, you do not get that in anywhere else, and yet you got that in 52, which is certainly
And it's the thing that I loved so much about it from the beginning. I mean, if it's one thing that is just a part of, you know, my taste and my personality, is that, you know, I love, you know, the character actors and the underdogs and, you know, the supporting parts and, you know, things like that. So to me, that tagline, you know, a year without Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman is not a year without heroes. You say to me a year without Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman, and I'm immediately so much more interested than any kind of big title where it's like, there will be a this, and Superman, and Batman, and Wonder Woman will have to figure out how to lead all the heroes. I'm like, well, they've got 1,000 of their own books. You know, like, just the notion that we were going to pull those big personalities out of the way for a year, to me, just made the book have so much potential. You know, because already those, you know, out from under their shadow can be those characters who we don't, you know, the writers don't turn to in a crisis. You know, there's something so great about, you know, Steel having to step up and save Metropolis in a moment where Superman can't. It's great, you know, because Superman usually does doesn't mean he's the only one that can.
Well, it's funny because there's a definite feeling of people kind of going through DC's attic and dusting off the toys that nobody's been playing with much lately.
Mm.
And, you know, I'd like to see them do this kind of a series again, taking other characters that have, you know, once been very viable commodities and have since fallen into obscurity and make something of them.
Sure.
Because Renee Montoya, her growth from where she started in issue one to where we leave off at the end of 52 was just a very, in some cases, perhaps telegraphed, but a very good, solid character growth for her becoming the new Question. And I think most people early on, you know, realized they were going to do something with her. Would she be Batwoman? Would she be Question? There was some definite, you know, room for speculation there. But she probably, and I'd have to go, you know, count the pages or whatever, got more screen time or more panel time, page time, whatever, in over the course of 52 than if it had been a six-issue miniseries with just her and the old Question.
Sure.
Especially since that, you know, that miniseries would probably need to give a real indication that she's going to take over that role by, like, the middle or the end of the first issue.
Exactly.
That transformation would have had to have been rushed, whereas, you know, in because they had 52 issues, they could really leverage how much time that growth could take.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, another thing that you were able to get there is that she was showing up in other people's stories as well. I mean, she was one of the Bridger characters where you saw Montoya, I'd say, pretty much everywhere but space. You know,
Really, you had the Black Adam, the Inner Gang, and the Oolong Island stories all kind of cross-pollinating each other.
Well, yeah, I got
really,
I guess
outside
so.
of the Question storyline, the only place we really see Montoya is Black Adam's. We never see her interacting with the Oolong Island people.
Yeah, true.
We never see her with Booster or Ralph or the Everyman stuff.
It's probably because she was on screen so much that it felt like she was in other places at once, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. She got a lot of good screen time.
Yeah.
The disappointment I have with her becoming the Question, one, I'm happy with that and think it's a good move and an interesting direction for the character. But we've taken two of the really well-established normal people leads out of Gotham Central. We've gotten Renee Montoya. She's now a masked vigilante. We took Crispin Allen. He's now the Spectre. You know, they have – DC as a whole has very few solidly developed normal heroic supporting characters. You know, people who are not a Jimmy Olsen, okay, he's going to go get in trouble, whatever, this issue sort of thing. Or a clear subsidiary role like Alfred is to Batman or whatever.
Hmm.
So to take a few of those and just put them into existing costumes, a little disappointing.
Well, isn't it also sort of interesting that sort of the new generation of the Gotham Central were replaced by the old guard? Once Renee Montoya and Crispin Allen, you know, are gone, they get replaced by Commissioner Gordon back in the Batman universe and Harvey Bullock back in the Batman universe. So, you know,
I don't see them as direct replacements, but they're back.
Well, but when you think about it, though, they sort of are the replacements in, say, the supporting role, because you're going to be seeing those two pretty much as you used to see Crispus and Renee.
That's true. I mean, there is a sense, as is so often the case, of kind of getting back to the roots. You know, suddenly, instead of a person watching a movie and then opening a Batman comic and going, oh, but where's Commissioner Gordon? Who's this guy that's the boss? And who are these people? You know, where's Harvey Bullock? You kind of now open a Batman comic and, you know, the Commissioner is playing the same role that he sort of always played, and Bullock's back. I mean, there is that a little bit of that sense of soft reboot, you know,
yeah,
to a person that wouldn't know a Montoya or a Crispus Allen. I take your point, though, too, John, that, I mean, and I am kind of mixed. I mean, I really enjoyed the Montoya, Charlie stuff. I am intrigued to see Montoya be the Question, but at the same time, there was a part of me that I would have been just as happy if she kind of got through it and was still, you know, she wasn't an alcoholic anymore, she wasn't drinking anymore, but didn't need to become a superhero. You know, like, I take your point that not everybody that's a supporting character needs to grow up to be a superhero. You know,
yeah,
it's not all the people out of costume around the heroes are just waiting for some mantle to land on them. You know, so it's like I am kind of mixed on how that story turned out. I also, you know, I just love the Vic Sage or Charlie Question character. I mean, I love that series. I mean, I never thought I'd get more stories with him, certainly not good stories with him. So
yeah,
it was worth it to have him on board. But I am a little bit ambivalent about, you know, Montoya instead of being a really tough, interesting, you know, police officer, which is what she used to be, or even PI, now being somebody who goes, no, actually, I will put a mask on and punch people and jump off buildings. You know, I will say, though, getting back to a point from earlier, that I am glad that even though it would have been fun to see Montoya and even the Question interact with more characters, I'm glad that she wasn't, like, out there on the battlefields of World War III. Like,
yeah,
I am glad that shoehorn her into that, because it just would be world, you know, it just wouldn't fit.
There were a couple of people at World War III that it's like, okay, you're going up against Black Adam, who's one of the strongest people on the planet, one of the meanest people on the planet, and pretty good, you know, strategist, too. And, okay, what's your powers? You shoot bows and arrows. Got it. Okay, cannon fodder. You go over there.
Yeah.
What do? You don't even shoot bows and arrows. Okay, you're dead now.
I'm the best boxer in the world. That's great. That's great. You know, I don't think anybody's on monitor duty right now, so,
yeah,
you know, it'd be great if you could just do that. When people get back, they're going to be real hungry, so if you could just, you know, monitor, maybe just ring up and, you know, get some sandwiches that'd be
Green
great.
Arrows.
We're going to go fight
your
that war.
Your chili is what we need. We don't need your boat
right.
Your chili is what we need.
I'm not quite sure if Wildcat knows how to cook. I don't know.
Does it matter?
He can order. Everybody in New York knows how to order out.
That's true. That's certainly true, yes.
That was my biggest disappointment with World War III, was the lack of a plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just sort of all rushed in there and hoped that people didn't die.
They didn't even rush in there. It's like, okay, let's stand outside of China for a couple of days.
Well, you know, that actually, that part I kind of liked. I mean, I did like the fact that I wish that it only ended up being called World War III because that was what was at stake, was preventing World War, you know,
yeah.
That the notion of borders and needing to respect China's border and not violate it and not trigger a nuclear war, that actually was really interesting to me, and I kind of liked that build up on the border, and then the moment they could sort things out, they can go in. But I agree that once it was time to kind of, you know, for a moment there, it was that same thing that you get so bored of from event books, which is like, quick, everybody, there's the camera. Everybody fly forward. You know, like,
yeah,
you just
yeah.
don't want there to be, you want to get to enjoy them being a little more clever. Yeah, like, if they're going to be sitting on the border for 6 days, the moment they get to go, there should have been a more enjoyable, better, bigger plan.
Yeah.
Or at least people talking about, we don't have a plan, we need a plan, we're going to get our butts kicked.
Yeah.
You know, something.
Yeah. You know, and that, to me, what should have been more at stake is not the notion that this is such a big deal, it's World War III. It's rather, how are we going to defeat, you know, superhero punch-ups have spilled over into international politics. How do we keep nations from nuking each other while we get one of our own under control? Like, to me, that's
yeah.
what was at stake, but it wasn't quite what got articulated in that issue.
Yeah, I think it would have been funny if they had just done something as stupid as have somebody with super ventriloquism try and make it seem like Black Adam shouted Shazam. It's like, I know it's not going to work, but let's try it anyways, yeah, guys.
You know, I'm sure that there was probably a member of the Everyman team that had that power once upon a time.
Probably.
I hope you take this as a compliment, John, but you have a Silver Age imagination. That would be exactly how that story would end in a Silver Age. You'd be like, well, thank God we brought ventriloquism, lad. And then they'd all laugh or something, you know. And there's nothing wrong with that.
The funny thing is, the whole storyline there, you know, the whole battle seemed to end with the whole Kingdom Come tactic of, I'll shout Shazam, the lightning will come blast the other guy, I'll shout it a few more times, sooner or later he'll get worn out. You know, this was a different twist on it, of course, with the changing of the magic word, etc.
Yeah.
It's like, didn't we see this a couple of issues back when he was fighting the Four Horsemen?
Yeah.
You know? It was...
Yeah.
Well, I mean...
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I have high expectations. They
sure.
delivered on 52.
No, and that's fair. I mean, it
to deliver more.
And remember, I mean, World War III was that thing that we all read on the chalkboard ages ago and went, what's that going to be? You know? And I think for me, I assumed way back when that would be that point where all the storylines would come crashing together. You know, the world that, you know, even, you know, what it was that Buddy saw out in space was going to somehow be informing something that was happening in World War III. You know, like, I think I assumed into World War III, I put my hopes that would be where all these plot lines would come crashing together. So,
and
you know,
solicitation certainly made it seem like it was going to be that. You know, they build it as if this was, you know, something that you had to see. It's so big that we can't contain it in this one issue. So, you know, have the first couple of hours in the first issue, have the first couple of hours in the second issue, the next couple of hours in the third issue, the next couple of hours in the fourth issue. But instead, we got what we did, where we had the entire week in 52 and then, you know, the side stories.
Now,
to their credit, though, that was the right choice because, I mean, I'm glad, since it seems like the creative team in 52 had no control over, you know, the four tie-ins tacked like lead weights to 52 as a series. They also, at no point did they need to hamstring what they were doing to leave room for that. So I am glad that it was open and shut. You know, if anything, this is another point where the marketing department does creative no help. The fact that there were going to be these tie-ins only increased our expectations of what World War III needed to be.
Yeah.
And it really only, it kind of would have worked okay if it was just a big payoff to the Black Adam story.
Well, the only problem I had on the 52 side of the World War III equation was the two words on the cover that says, begins here.
That's a good point.
I read that first and then read the others, and it's like, well, the others didn't tell me anything new.
Yeah.
And if it had just been World War III, then I could have just – it would have been easier to ignore.
Exactly, yeah.
But
yeah.
The other thing that really just confused the hell out of me as to whose idea was this and what the hell were they thinking. We've gone through at that point 50 issues of 52 – We've got a lot of story that's built up. It's getting harder and harder for new readers to get on board. There is no story thus far. Okay, and we talked about this in our last conversation. You know, do you really need that or not? But then in World War III, a four-issue series that all comes out on the same week. So in theory, people who are reading them back to back to back to back. Mm. There's a story thus far in there. It's like, why put it over there? Why didn't you add that to 52?
Yeah.
It just it didn't make sense to me.
Well, they could have done things differently. But, you know, I mean, the way that it happened, you know, we can't change it after the fact. So, I mean, we can say in our minds that the rest of World War III was the rest of World War III. It was not part of 52. However, it was when it came out, so.
Yeah. And I hope that they don't collect it with the rest of 52.
They probably will.
If they're going to collect it, fine, but I hope they don't, because I just, I don't know.
Yeah.
If they want to collect it, it should be its own trade. It should not be part of Volume 4 of 52.
I agree. Yeah, it could just be its own thing, which is best ignored.
Well, if they do collect it, though, knowing DC Comics, they probably will include issue 50 as part of that trade. Now, it's...
I don't think they need to.
I don't think they need to either. But from the way that they have done things in the past where they put multiple issues and multiple trades, like, for instance, with Infinite Crisis, there were the prelude trades and, like, the tie-in trades that had, you know, one issue from one thing, one issue to another. Chances are they probably would include, you know, 52 number 50. Even though 52 number 50 would be in the 52 trades by itself, I would not be surprised if they do make a World War III trade with 52 number 50 as the first issue there, or even as the last issue there, and then put 1, 2, and 3 of World War III.
They could, but I doubt they will.
I mean, you know, the DC trade policy seems to be best described as like witchcraft and sorcery with very little logic.
Exactly.
But, I mean, I could see them doing it if they did it in both places. I mean, I think they would be, you know, it would be a really poor move if somebody that's reading 52 in trades doesn't get issue 50 in those sequential volumes because issue 50 is only put in a World War III trade. I could see them putting it in both places or doing the thing that some of the Infinite Crisis trades did, which is to pull maybe a couple key pages out of 52 issue 50 and put them in. You know, for, in the same way that, I forget, I think there's a Teen Titans trade that I have because I've been reading the Geoff Johns Teen Titans in trade. A number of pages from Infinite Crisis are actually reprinted in one of the trades. And that actually kind of works. I mean, it flows because, you know, Connor's death didn't appear in Titans, it appeared in Infinite Crisis. So for those Teen Titans readers, they kind of needed to know that. So I could see them doing that, but I think if they pulled the whole issue into a World War III trade, that'd be a pretty poor choice.
Yeah.
I have to wonder if they did the miniseries for World War III as a concession to the fact that maybe not everybody who might need to follow that story was getting 52.
Mm. They might have, however, I still think that they did the World War III story to appease those who were already reading 52 that were wondering where the hell were the rest of the characters we were promised. And they tried to put all of those characters in the World War III, and it just didn't work because they were trying to do too much at once and took away from the full scope of what World War III was going to be in the first place.
Yeah, it's just, I go back to they didn't know what they were doing in terms of some of the stuff they did in World War III contradicted what happened in 52, contradicts what happens 1 year later. It just, they may have had the best of intentions, but it was a little weak on the execution.
Or they had poor intentions. I mean, there's also something to be said for whether it was just a, honestly, I mean, whether it was like the kind of the one time where 52 was selling so well that they just couldn't resist a little cash grab. You know, I mean, I'm not going to assume they were above that.
So,
I mean,
in other words, Earth 3 Dan DiDio approved this?
If they were going for the cash grab, I think they would have had the 52 creative team at least involved more on an oversight level.
Maybe. I mean, if they had the time, though. I mean, like, I wonder how late in the process this thing was greenlit. You know, I mean, and whether there was even that amount of time to be got from that creative team. I mean, I don't know how stretched in they were at that point, but I could be wrong. But, you know, but I mean, it does certainly, I mean, clearly selling some extra funny books was the real reason, but I do think that they wanted it to fill those holes. It just did a poor job of it. I mean, I do think that, of course, they wanted to feel like they could satisfy all of the people out there with lingering, you know, Aquaman questions. It's just that there's kind of no good way at that in that late date and with different creators to go about that. You know, so I just think they should have better left alone. You know, I mean, it's funny. The thing that I wish that they'd done instead with those lingering plot threads is at the point where it was clear 52 wasn't going to get to them, where they said, you know what, there's just nowhere else in this thing we can fit Squidface Aquaman and whatever the heck it was that happened to him. So sorry to keep picking on Aquaman. Then that should just become, you know, it's like, you know, send a kind of mea culpa memo to whoever it is that edits Aquaman and go, you know what, at some point you need to fit in, even if it's a one-shot or a fill-in issue or something, do an issue that's kind of like, here's the missing Aquaman stuff, but yeah, give it to the Aquaman people to handle, you know, I mean.
Well, like they did the Nightwing annual.
I was just going to say.
Yeah, exactly, do an annual, you know, that's the great, you know, and then let it be handled by people who are going to be a little more, that are more invested in it. I mean, I really like John Ostrander, but what does he possibly have invested in any of these characters? You know, what's it to him whether a Harvey Dent scene that, you know, is not going to have anything to do with anything he's writing is great or not? I mean, it's not that I'm saying he doesn't want to do the best work that he can do. I'm sure he did. It's just that, like, it's like they kind of brought in outsiders to do this. And it's so different than, you know, to me, the perfect model of how you handled the 52 one-year later transition, and you referenced this earlier, John, is the way that it works with Green Arrow. You know, it's like we got just a few touches of Green Arrow in 52 so that we kind of knew, oh, this is when he wins the election. You know, there's a few little moments where you see him, but then all the rest of the story of what happens to Green Arrow, which isn't important to 52, was done really well by Judd Winnick in the book where it belongs.
Yep.
You know, like there was a point where,
yeah,
1 year later hit, you meet the new status quo, everybody's changed, a few characters are still missing, you kind of go, wow, this is mysterious, I wonder what happened. You explore the new status quo a bit, and then you do a story arc where you kind of go, okay, time to go see what happened during that year. And, you know, that those details are only of interest to somebody that cares about Green Arrow. So there's no reason to shove them into 52. And had the 52 writers handled it, they probably would have just ended up messing up something that Judd Winnick had planned. You know,
sure.
Like I'm sure,
yeah,
Judd Winnick wouldn't want even people that he trusts handling, you know, it's like because all you're doing is giving marching orders to other people. It's like, on some level, not to get back to this favorite issue, but it's, I mean, I wish they'd done it with Hawk Girl. What is she? She's Hawk Girl.
Hawk Girl.
Yeah.
I didn't want to disrespect her. With Hawk Girl, the story of her struggle and being, you know, being in that hospital and all that stuff, that would have been great in her own book. Throw it in her book.
Mm-hmm.
Have that be,
and
you know,
if they had ever mentioned it in any way, shape, or form, I would agree with you entirely.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I wish they had, because that should be, you know, what should, you know, even if the person writing Hawk Girl might not have been thrilled with that as an idea, maybe they kind of go, what? She was 25 feet tall? That's stupid. Like, even if they don't like it, they could do something with it. So it's like, 52 presented this that happened to your character a year ago. Reference it, deal with it, make something of it. Spin it your own way. Take this detail, bring it back into the world of the book that you write, and make something of it. And I just think that would have been the best way for
really
all those things to be handled.
The decision on what changes to make should have been driven by the creators on those other books.
I agree. And in some cases, I think they were. I mean, I do think
that
stuff did. I think that the places where that derailed were probably those one-year later books where either new creators were brought in or creators changed quite quickly. Like Hawk Girl.
Hawk Girl had the same writer pretty much the whole time.
He's talking about for when 1 year later happened. Before 1 year later, that was not the same people who were doing it.
It was Chaykin and Simonson. Simonson's been on.
Oh, really?
Maybe. Yeah.
Oh, you know what? Then my mistake. I'm remembering that wrong then. Okay.
But on the Nightwing thing, Bruce Jones was there for the six issues and out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, too, that I remember, Walt Simonson, a little shifty. Shifty. Not as shifty as Mark Waid.
Yeah,
okay, I don't know.
But then again, who is? No, I'm just
kidding. You gotta watch out for those people. Yeah,
but you know what I mean. Like, so I think that there were probably some internal problems with creators and directions and things on 1 year later that weren't working. And you know, I just think it's a shame that some of that stuff ended up getting left at 52's doorstep. I mean, it's fair because, of course, as it was originally planned, 52 was going to take care of all that. But there just comes a point where you kind of, you know, you sort of send that message back to the various editors involved, going, you know what, there's kind of enough to do over here, so if you could just sort this stuff out.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I mean, I certainly don't hold anything against 52 on things that were outside of it.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
You know, in terms of expectations that 1 year later may have brought to bear or whatever. To me, it's a question of what did 52 set up, what did 52 develop, what did 52 pay off? And in those equations, did it do a good job?
And I'm sure that one of the reasons why we got Teen Titans in 52 was because, well, the writer of Teen Titans was writing 52. You know? And I mean, we did get pretty much everything that we were missing from the Teen Titans story 1 year later throughout 52. You know, not every other book was lucky, but, well, because Geoff Johns wrote 52, was one of the writers on 52, his stuff got worked out perfectly.
You know what would have been a really funny way to handle the Titan stuff, though?
What?
Is if every few issues you had basically some TV in the background doing the equivalent of, you know, the Avengers new membership press conference thing with Titans.
Oh, that would have been perfect.
And it's almost like clockwork. It's like, okay, these are the new Titans. 2, 3 issues later, these are the new Titans.
And then young Frankenstein goes, Teen Titans friends, and then he does.
Yeah, that would have been funny. And I do like the sense that in that year, and it was a clever way to kind of make these teams, to answer the question why these teams weren't solving all of the world's problems, but I do like that in the course of the 52 year, you know, the JSA wasn't around for most of it. The Titans were completely chaotic and rudderless. The Justice League didn't really exist, and when they tried to, it was a mess. I kind of like the notion that in the internal history of the DC Universe, that will be a year that won't be remembered well by most of the people that experienced it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, here's as good a spot as any to end this episode as, well, we went for 3 hours and about 20 minutes, possibly even longer than that, on 52. So I am definitely going to be splitting this episode up into 2 parts. So expect the second part of this episode sometime early next week, possibly on Tuesday or Wednesday. We also have just recorded the 22 pages number 3 on Nova number 1 and 2. It was myself, Chris Chavez, who's Equinox on the forums, and Nightwing BK himself, Grant Cassina, joining in on that as well. That one's either going to be out by the end of next week or the beginning of the week after that, but we definitely have at least 1 episode per week for the next couple of weeks, so all has been good. And also, I want to thank everybody for their patience in the past couple of weeks. It's been a bit more difficult for me to get to editing these episodes with work and all that, so again, I appreciate your patience. I try my hardest to get out at least 1 episode per week, and I will certainly be doing that in the future as well. So once again, here, this is the end of episode 39 part 1, and episode 39 part 2 will follow early next week. I want to thank John Mayo of the Mayo Report and the Comic Book Page Podcast for joining me in this episode. You can find him over at comicbookpage.com, and he has a full listing of episodes he's been on here at Comic Timing, as well as episodes in other places as well on the website. And I want to thank David D. as well for joining me here. Always a pleasure to have David on. He carries himself in a conversation better than anybody I know, so certainly want to thank him for joining me here. The email address for Comic Timing is comictiming@gmail.com. Don't forget to check out the forums over at cgspodcast.com/forum, which are graciously hosted by the Comic Geek Speak guys over at comicgeekspeak.com. We are proud members of the Comics Podcast Network over at comicspodcast.com. Please vote for us on Podcast Alley. The links are in the show notes and on the main page. There's a full listing of Podcast Alley listings on the Comic Timing forums. Please dig us on dig.com. There's also a listing for gig sites on the Comic Timing forums. And please send us an iTunes review on iTunes if you get a chance. That would certainly be graciously appreciated. So once again here, thanks for everybody for joining me here, and for John and for David, I'm Ian Levitsy, reminding everybody that there's always time for comics. But isn't that always the case? I mean, come on, whether it's the United States, whether it's Skeets, you get too close and you're
that's right. I hope, by the way, that the tinfoil hat that I wear when we talk about this won't, you know, interfere with any of the subjects. on my cordless phone. Let me know if it does.
I'll certainly make sure to let you know, and worst comes to worst, we can get you a tinfoil antenna just to use.
For cone of silence.
Exactly.
Cone of silence. That's the way to go.
Ooh, bringing out the cone of silence already, and the episode hasn't even started yet. Nice. Oh, boy. All right, so we've got a crap load of stuff to actually cover here. So, to say the least, we're not going issue by issue, or else it would be a 52-episode podcast.
You mean you don't want to...
issue by issue, page by page, panel by panel, I mean, come on!
Dot by dot.
Yeah, we've only got 30 issues to go since the last broadcast.
34 if you count World War III, but please, let's not...
Right.
I have 4 hours of recording space on this, so if we go back...
Let's not have that be the goal.
Yes, exactly.
We want 5.2 or nothing.
Oh, shit, you're right, man. I should... I swear to God, if this would go 5 hours and even 2 minutes, I would be happy. You know? Or 52 seconds, you know? I mean, we just have a 52-second podcast.
You would be happy, and I believe my girlfriend would leave me. By the end of that 5th hour, she would have packed the cat, and it would just be me in the boxes.
Well, I certainly
so you'd have more time to read. I'm not saying
I'd have plenty of time. That's right. Yeah, you know. In fact, I'd begin reading 52 right then.
As long as she puts some air bubbles in the boxes
until you guys
and the
hang
cats
up
can breathe, then that's fine.
That's right.
Oh.